Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below. A check-in interview with Clint Bauer about his dream to get chemicals and massive, very expensive machinery out of broad-acre row crop farming, aka soy and corn farming, which currently occupies millions of acres around the world, especially in large industrialized agriculture countries. We check in what has happened and has changed. Farmers and many others in this space see that the era of chemicals is ending. It might not look like it, but we have already won. Chemical-free broadacre farming is totally possible. And now it's about execution. What else has changed? And is Clint still interested in integrating animals? And why has Chipotle invested in the company? This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investinginregenag. That is gumroad.com/investinginregenag. Or find the link below. Welcome back to another episode. Today with the founder and CEO of Greenfield, Chem-Free AI-powered robotics. They're swarming the fields across the country. They're based in Kansas, USA. And we already had Clint on the podcast, and I checked it before going live 3.5 years ago, so in the summer of 2020. They're still there, which is already a huge accomplishment. And I'm looking forward to checking in and see what has happened on the chem-free side of things, on the robotic side, and so much more. So welcome back, Clint.
Hey, glad to be back. Yeah, it's a borderline miracle. We're still here, so thrilled.
And for the people, of course, I will link the previous interview in the show notes below and in the description, but just to give them a bit of a snapshot, actually now of Greenfield, when you're at a dinner party or somewhere or in a flight or next to somebody that has no clue what you're doing and they ask, what do you do? How do you normally, keep it nicely and polite and not go into 2 hours of rambling about chemicals. What do you normally describe yourself and describe your company?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. Robots that eliminate chemicals and in fields, crop fields, and keep the carbon in the ground.
That's interesting. I think you added that the carbon piece. Is that a recent addition to the tech or to the intro line?
I don't know. It just, I'm not sure when we added that, but that's always been the goal is no-till, you know, and so enabling no-till to scale without chemicals. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot of folks are worried about carbon, as we know. So I figure, well, it's worth them understanding that, else it leads to, oh, well, why not organic and all that? So.
And just to make it visual for people, like swarming the fields, and of course you have to, and now even though you probably were doing that before as well, mention AI in your title, otherwise people might lose interest. But what does swarming the fields mean? Like, how big are they? How... unless you've seen them on Instagram or in real life, like just to give people an understanding of what swarming and the fields in this case mean. Like, how do you deploy these? Do they fly out of a truck? Yeah. Are they in the thousands? Like, what does swarming mean?
Not in the thousands yet, but we'll deploy this last season. We had 10 bots on most of the fields running at a given time. and they're running between the rows currently is the way they operate. And so all 10 of them, one person this last year could keep an eye on about 10 of them. And so that's what they do. And so they're weeding between the rows currently. And, you know, eventually they'll do more.
And yeah, because we discussed that last time as well. I think there was an animal integration thought there. But between the rows of, let's say, corn, soy, like your standard, actually many, many hectares and acres in the US specifically, but many other places as well are planted with that. And your goal is to get the chemicals out of that rotation or get the chemical out of that production system without complicating your life or actually just making it possible. Because I think a strong point of our previous conversation was it's almost, if not impossible, to do it without the robots, or you go hand weeding. But yeah, that doesn't really, like, weeds is a huge issue for no-till.
Yeah, that's right. When you look at a no-till environment, and I'll just speak to where we're at in South Central Kansas, but a lot of the other methods that are being used to weed are dependent on what you do before you plant the crop, meaning till. And if you don't till in this region and a lot of places, you have a grass or a vining weed that simply you can't use lasers or other methods to get rid of because they're just too numerous. And so you need to have mechanical capabilities. And that's why chemicals have won, right? They're super efficient. And so that's sort of what we're up against is how do we replace chemicals with mechanical capabilities?
And the autonomous piece. So what has changed in the last 3.5 years, let's say, in robotics? I think there have been a few other companies popping up. There have been, might already been working on it. And of course, the AI boom exploded. But like on the robotics piece, have there been huge advantages in terms of core technology, or what have you seen in the last 3.5 years on the robotics piece?
Yeah, you're starting to see. I mean, if you're indoor and you're in highly structured systems indoor, you know, there are a bunch of technologies there that are available. I think you're looking at, you know, ROS and ROS 2 robotic operating system, which they're not really operating systems. Those are becoming pretty standard, but you can't rely on that at this point. I think anyone who's doing what we're doing or attempting to do anything in fields either has learned that or is about to learn that. And so the standards are improving, but they're nowhere near where they'll be, you know, 10 years from now. And it's kind of like I always tell people, you know, I started in the internet in 1997, and the stuff we were doing in 1997 is really easy now, right? Anyone can do, and it's just simple, and even an AI could do it now. And so, but in 1997, it was incredibly difficult. So I see the same thing with robotics. It'll develop over the next 10 years, and some of the things we're doing today will be easier by then.
And how has been the reception by farmers because they're taking quite a risk. Like if it doesn't work, I mean, they still have to go out and spray. And maybe, I mean, what's been the reception on the farmer side there's another person. I mean, you're a third generation farmer. There's a fundamental difference piece there, but another person that comes with a fancy tech solution to do something. And they've seen probably 100+ and 100+ in the graveyard as well. So what has been your reception with farmers, customers, clients that need to accept your robots into their fields?
Yeah, I think at a high level, the thing that's changed really in the last 15 years since I came back to Kansas with farmers is they all agree the chemicals need to go. That's changed. They all see the risk and that kind of stuff. But we don't even ask them to agree with that. We don't even really have that conversation unless they want to have it. We really just start very simply and say, look, there's no resistance to blades, right? And so that's step one. And the second thing is our robots actually damage. This year, we should be at 1% or less of the crop on the entire field. And when you run a big spray rig, you're at 3% plus. And so we just break it down very easily.
Meaning the sprayer and the big tractor, et cetera, damage about 3% of your plants that are out there, and your robots should be down by one third, basically, of that.
Yep. On a 30-inch row crop, that's about the rate, 3% plus. And so we just say, listen, you know, you've almost half paid for us in this region at that point. And so, you know, we just start there. And it's very simple from that perspective. And they can always go scramble a spray rig if something goes wrong, you know. But last year we had, I think, zero instances of that, maybe one. So, you know, and when we had it before that, it was just because we were moving slower than we had hoped. But now we're moving at a pretty good clip. So,
And just to come back to the point you made, like, compared to 15 years ago, farmers agree chemicals need to go. What has made that shift? Like, why is that, let's say, consciousness or that? Why has that moved in the last 15 years?
I think there is an awareness that have grown around them that one, farmers are starting to look at the sheer amount of money that they're spending on chemicals and the resistance genes and what's happening, and sort of a loss of control, not only over the weeds, but their own operations to some extent. But then I think the second thing is, you know, I got into this because of my dad's Parkinson's, and which I think came from farm chemicals, and the rest of my family thinks so too. And so
it's considered a farmer disease, like a work-related disease in France. Yeah. Like, yeah. No questions asked, you get an unemployment benefit if you're a farmer and you get Parkinson's.
Really? Yeah. That's fascinating.
Because the connection has been made. And I've seen, there was because there's a huge discussion, and they lost it actually in Europe, on pesticide reduction. And France was very strong about it because have acknowledged that a long time ago. And the simple lawyers in the court case were like, yeah, we have the cases. It's not even a discussion anymore. You just get unemployment benefits. And for quite a few years now, it's considered a work-related disease, which is horrible, but at least we're to that level. But it's unfortunately only France, not the rest of Europe. So the pesticide reduction law didn't get through the parliament. But yeah, we're working on it.
That's amazing. I actually didn't realize that. Yeah, and I think that folks are seeing more and more the Parkinson's. Let's just focus on that for now. The Parkinson's incidence is growing. I mean, it's interesting when I just talk with folks about this, farmers or otherwise in the area, almost everyone knows someone with Parkinson's now. And I don't think that was the case 15 years ago. And so it's just growing and growing and growing. And so I think that is a big part of it, you know. And I think any farmer has to think about, okay, when I'm cleaning out my spray rig, what am I doing at my farm, right? Where is that going? Even if you use best methods, it's probably using a garden hose, and it's probably somewhere on your farm. And you have kids running around, and it's just not a great thing. And so when they see that we have an alternative and starting to understand the greater vision, they buy into it, you know, and they want to be supportive. And I think what I hear now most of the time is, we want to see you win. In fact, I hear that almost every single time.
And for farmers, you mentioned it pays for itself, like already, like half of it through the simple the reduction in loss of crop. And then how does the business case work for the other half? Like, how interesting is it? You're still a small company. There are still a lot of things moving, but you're working with quite a few customers. Like, how interesting is the business case? If I'm only interested, I don't believe the Parkinson piece, I'm ignoring the carbon piece, I'm ignoring everything else, but I'm interested in pure dollars. Like, how do you convince me?
Yeah. Normally we have it at that point, to be honest, but it's, I think after that, you know, if I feel any skepticism, which is pretty rare past that point, but we just talk about, look, go walk out in your soybean field after it's sprayed and let me know what you see in the heat of the day, right? And they're suffering, even with the genetics. And so we don't have that problem, right? And so we're not creating suffering on the plants by over-the-top spraying. And so there's some yield loss happening there, right, when a plant's suffering. We don't have that data, hard data. There are reports and stuff. We're gathering data on it and researching it, but we don't put a number forward with them on that like we do the other. So there's that. And then the last thing I ask them is, do you want to, you know, be in control of your own business eventually or not? Do you want to reduce your dependency someday? And right now you're dependent on these genetics built into every single seed, and you can't save your seed. You have to pay extra for those genetics, so the sprays will work with it. And are you happy with that? Because we're on a path to get rid of all of them, and then you opens up a whole different world of seed choices, right? And do you want to be a farmer that is growing plants, or do you want to be a farmer that's talking about your equipment and your chemical choices all day? So I think most farmers would rather be growing interesting crops and enjoying the biology of it in the grazing and all that than chemical selection, arguing whether they're efficient or not, and buying really expensive equipment and financing it. So it's, yeah.
And in your like customer set, like how many are then jumping beyond the GMO, beyond the plug and play set that most others are doing? Like how enabling is this technology, I think, is what I'm wondering about.
Well, the non-GMO
anyway, doing what they maybe wanted to do it anyway, and they use this as, okay, this is the moment to go.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's happening right now. We're not asking them to, because right now I'm still saying, look, you know, have a backup and go ahead and buy those genetically modified seeds right now and use them like you always do, right? I want you to have a safety net until you get comfortable working with us. So we don't make that ask yet. And so that's kind of where it stands currently. So I'm not aware of anyone going, okay, great, I'm running around trying to buy non-GMO seed. That said, since the Chipotle investment, we've always had quite a few farms kind of coming to our doors from all over the world. And I don't have a number on that, but it has exploded, since the Chipotle deal was, announced. And a lot of those farms are saying they're growing non-GMO crops, stuff like that, because they really do struggle with weed control on a post-plant, basis.
And so you brought it up yourself. Of course, we're gonna talk about it, but let's do that now. So something else that has changed significantly in the last 3.5 years was a relatively recent Chipotle, the casual fast food chain in the US, has agreed to invest. So how did that come about? I mean, they've been quite vocal about their role in the food chain or the food system for a long time, and they've made some investments left and right, I think. But how did they come to you, or how they land on robotics and row cropping and chemicals? I mean, the chemical piece I find easy, but the rest, like how did the deal come about?
Yeah. It was Cultivate Next, which is their venture arm. And we got to know those guys and reached out to them, and they got back to us and eventually, and they came out and saw what we were doing. And, I think the biggest challenge we've had is that we're based in Kansas, and a lot of firms just won't take the time to fly and understand what agriculture looks like here, right? And so they did. And to be blunt, I believe every single potential investor that's been to the farm invested. And so I could be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure that's true. Yeah, it's a good filter. And I think when you see them, you realize, hey, there's some great potential here. And so I think the other thing that was notable to them was just the fact, I'd built this regenerative supply chain with Canada Pet Food, and that the robots are now integrating into that. And so, we understand a little bit about ingredient supply chains and the complexity involved. And I think that was, a portion of it, right? I think the math, that they've bought into is the same as ours, that, longer term, really small machines that are reconfigurable makes a lot of sense. And financial sense, as well as the chemical, no chemical mandate that we're working towards.
And are they going to connect you to farm? I mean, many are reaching out now, but connect you to farmers in their supply chain, or how does it work? Is it a pure financial investment, or is there also supply chain interest, let's say, from their procurement arm, or however that works with them?
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things about Chipotle and Cultivate Next is they seem to work together, and they have other investments in companies that are being implemented into their with their farm partners. And so that was one of the compelling things to us. And in fact, I'll be out there pretty soon, you know, walking around with at least the first set of farms and kind of seeing, okay, how do we integrate into this potentially? So, you know, they seem to work through that, and it's not just talk. So that's super compelling from my perspective.
No, of course. And then just on a practical level, how many robots like have you buzzing around now, or in terms of scale, just to understand, is it in the tens, in the hundreds, or in the thousands? And if Chipotle says we have 10 farms here that need them, like how easy is it to get to like the numbers that, or are they rotating? Let's say you don't need so many because you're rotating. Like how many robots are you going to control by the end of the year?
Yeah, we're in a phase now where we're slowly expanding. We got to a point about halfway through last summer season, and we pulled back some of the fleet to engineering to start working on adding other capabilities and refining what we had, meaning other attachments and other sort of capabilities of the robots. And so on a broad acre basis, meaning, you know, all the crops you mentioned, plus cotton and sorghum and stuff like that here in the Midwest, the robots will be running well over, you know, starting April, moving forward about 240 days a year. And they're going to be doing a lot more than just, you know, cutting weeds. And so we're working on cover cropping and spraying and soil testing automated. And so that really is where we're going with it. So the expansion of the fleet, we're moving a little bit slower to make sure that we can add those capabilities, because why build another robot, too many of them, before you know how to add all those capabilities to them? And so that's where we're at. So we have, to answer your question directly, we have 20 robots today that we're running last summer, and we'll add another, you know, 10 by April, hopefully running in Texas and maybe doing some soil testing up here in Kansas. And then we'll add a few each month, and that pace will accelerate until we get to what we hope is a, you know, close to profit in 2025. And so that's sort of the plan.
And then from, I'm going to ask about the animal piece later, but then from the supply chain stuff, because I see you still work with a pet food company, which is great, meaning they're still around. And I think Snacktivist as well. Like, how has that world changed a bit or a lot or not at all, let's say, since we last talked, in terms of interest for chemical-free, interest for different sourcing, etc.? Has there been a shift there from the big buyers, let's say?
Yeah. You know, the work with Canada started before we even started Greenfield. And, of course, Canada's been through, you know, several acquisitions and mergers. And each time it occurred, I thought, well, maybe this is the end of the road. And actually, you know, each subsequent investor group or owner or whoever has actually increased their interest. Now, there's every time you have a change, there's, you know, some adjustment period. And that slowed us down a few times. And I think everybody can understand that. But, you know, this group now, I think, is committed. And I know their head of marketing is a guy who has a background in regenerative ag to some extent and is really into it. And so, and they came here and presented to about 35 farmers here at my farm, which is Greenfield HQ. And, you know, committed to in a few years, all of our grains and legumes, hopefully being sourced through farms that are on that regenerative track. And so I think what you're seeing, and Cohen, you've seen this for sure, is just this growing recognition among supply chains that this regenerative movement has legs, that it's growing.
It's real.
And yeah. It's real. And I think that has, in 2015, heck, I didn't even know the word regenerative when I started down the path with the supply chain with them, right? I was still called it integrated farming, right? And then we had a consultant a couple of years later go, listen, somebody's kind of doing these things you're working on, and it's called regenerative. I'm like, oh, okay, that's great.
Let's Google that.
And I'm like, oh, good. I don't have to like learn all these things. So a lot of guys have already figured out a fair amount of these things. So, and there's a name up for it. And so I think that is changing. you know, with that, the complexity of supply chains are substantial, right? And, you know, you're looking at the storage, or which could be anything from refrigeration to grain storage, which means you have to divide it and separate it. Identity preserved, I guess, is the term. And then you have to just think about, you know, what happens if you have a bad crop, right? And so for Canada, I believe most, if not all, the sorghum that goes into their pet food last year, we grew using, I mean, the robots weeded all those fields. And for that, one of the things we've done, which I think is interesting, if we look at sort of regenerative adoption, is one of the largest grain cooperatives in the U.S. actually invested in Greenfield a couple of years ago and partners with us, and they're named MKC. And so they have over 40 grain storage facilities, and they're finishing their third train loader, which means they can load about 100 cars with grain every 6 hours, train cars. And then they have these local facilities. So we've taken one of the local facilities that was maybe not being used as much, and now Canada works with them, and that's where all the sorghum is hauled to and kept separate from the rest. And so in that, you have a very large grain cooperative that's in the commodity business that's now getting in the identity preserved, and they actually help us with sort of the finance part of it, and they do the storage, they do the logistics, they help us find the farmers, and, you know, it won't always be this good, but I'm happy to say the farmers this past year got a substantial premium versus cash price at the time of harvest. And I mean substantial. And so farmers are starting to see that in this region. And I never promise, hey, we're going to get you in on these types of deals. The fact of the matter is there's 250 million acres of broad acre in the United States, and not everyone's going to get a premium. But it is a good way to spur also early adoption. Hey, as we make these deals, the earlier you get on the list, the better chance this could happen, but we make no guarantees, right? And so, but I think
if you're last on the list, it's not going to happen. Yeah.
That's right. Your wait and see attitude's not going to pay.
And so that's Shiva. And have there been others? Because of course, one company could just be an exception of, I mean, if they change ownership a few times, that might be a stronger trend. But have you seen others that are knocking on the door and wanting to get the chemical-free supply, identity preserved, et cetera?
Yes, I think we've had a lot of those discussions, and I'll be running around California, you know, pretty soon. Like I said, after the Chipotle announcement, a lot of more people realize we exist. I mean, we've kept pretty quiet. And part of that was,
you follow your LinkedIn and you can get a good impression. It's not that you're silent there. And for good reason. So yeah, you have to really not follow this space, let's say. But yeah, of course, if Chipotle announces something, it travels everywhere and press releases get shared and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It does. And so that's made a big difference. And yes, I think we're going to see more and more of this. But again, you've got to work through the complexity, right? And I know that some of the farms I'm going to look at, some of the brands I'm going to work with, I could tell they'd appreciate it when I say, well, look, I just need to come see your operation and understand how you work, right? Before we try to even put anything together, right? And so I think that instead of showing up in ag or food or supply chains or farmers, you don't show up and tell them how it's going to be. You show up and you listen. And since I am a farmer, that's been good on Broadacre. You know, I kind of have a pretty good idea how it goes. But some of these other deals that we're looking at, you know, I need to go and listen, and some of our other guys will go and listen, and we'll figure out how to make it work for them. Right. So.
Because weeds are an issue, not only in Broadacre. That's what you're hinting to.
Yeah. And cover cropping and all these things that folks want to do, you know.
And then how far is the animal integration piece down the list? Because last time you hinted towards that, and then it's of course way more complex than weeding, which is already complex. Imagine cover crop planting, imagine soil monitoring and research automatically. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I'll tell you. You know, everyone's got their Apple Newton experience or the thing that they wish they had not gone down the path the way they went down the path. And we've got a few chassis sitting around, pretty good sized ones on this grazing thing that, you know, we weren't too happy with in the end. And we've changed course a bit. I remain steadfast, and I know this is correct, we're doing it on my farm, in that cropland, all cropland will be grazed at some point. And it is absolutely financially the right move. And with cover crops, it makes a lot of sense. And so on my farm specifically, we're kind of going back old school. We're putting fence around all of my land this year. And we are, of course, grazing it. But we were doing it with these various apparatus that, you know, were automated or semi-automated. But it's a very difficult thing to win at. We have one more idea, and I've promised myself not to spend one more dime or amount of time on that particular idea until every other thing we have going is just cruising. And so, but
not soon. Yeah.
With putting electric fence. Yeah. But we're putting a 3-line electric fence, around the edge of all of our fields. Next to highways, we're actually putting a more intense fence than that, even since we have sheep. But guess what? We have robots that can follow things. And so they're actually going to cut, if there's weeds growing, to try to ground out the fence, they'll run along the fence and cut the weeds underneath the fence so it doesn't ground them out. And so for now, that's the way we see this working, you know, because a lot of times with electrified, maybe animals won't reach under there to keep that from happening, which is why the fences were removed years ago, right? Decades ago.
Because they were removed because of the, it was too time consuming to cut underneath.
Yeah. Because, the fence, you know, the weeds would grow up and then you can't get rid of them. And then they go to seed and now you have weeds in getting in your cropland. And so that's why a lot of fences, almost all cropland had fences in this area at one point. And then it, you know, like my grandpa ripped them out because, you know, two reasons. One, what I just stated, to you don't want the plow to hit the fence and all these mm-hmm. types of things that are now less of a problem
and less of an issue. Yeah.
And so I'm like, well, let's make a simpler thing here and let's just get the fence around the things around the edge of that. Let's eliminate that problem and fight another day, you know?
And so you're going down the route of cover crop seeding and also maintenance. Like what's, if then it's not going to be grazed, it has to be cut at some point, or it has to be mowed in, or like what is your approach there with cover crops?
Yeah, the cycle that we're working on right now is this, and let's just use one scenario. You have a sorghum or milo crop which grows in the summer in South Central Kansas, and so you plant that crop in. Let's just start at plant time. You know, April, May. In this area, or as late as almost up to 4th of July, I believe. You plant that crop, and somewhere between July and middle of September, you'll go in between the rows with our robots, and you'll put a cover crop with a little bit of seed-to-soil contact between those rows. And we've tested with cereal rye so far. So you put that cover crop in there. Your sorghum doesn't get harvested until, well, in drought. Hopefully you're not harvesting in September, but once in a while now you do. But September, October, November, right? Once you harvest that, you should have that rye or whatever you planted growing. And if you did it with our robots, you don't have to go in and drill it in post-plant and knock down all that milo or sorghum. So those creatures, whether they're sheep or cattle, in this instance, in this region, can graze not just the milo stalks that tear the leaves off them, and this is a common practice, but now you have cereal rye or whatever growing underneath those stalks, that nice green stuff to eat through the winter in this area. And so now you've got that growing. And then you do that through the winter, and then you can let that cover grow out in the spring. And you could, you know, in theory, let it go all the way to roller crimp, or our next robot that's coming that I'm not going to talk about in detail today works. It's been 3 years in the making, can work with that cover crop to eliminate any need for a burn down or residual herbicide. And then you can plant the crop. So that's what it does. You feed your animals through the winter You get use of all the plant material that's there. You avoid knocking it into the ground so the cattle or sheep aren't eating as much right on the ground. And now you're setting yourself up for less weed pressure, especially in the case of cereal rye. And as long as you're following with a crop that cereal rye can't impact, you set yourself up well for the spring, and then you moved down to the next rotation and so on and so forth. So that literally is the cycle we are pursuing today with farmers that plant sorghum or sunflowers or, you know, crops in 30-inch rows.
And how much of a jump is that for your neighbors, let's say, or like how much of a shift in practice or in theory as well, and in mindset, et cetera, to operate like that?
Yeah, there's a couple things. One, if you already have cattle, you recognize that value immediately. It's just a no-brainer. It really is. I mean, anyone's that are farmers, they get it right away. Like, oh yeah, sure. It drives my feed costs down. I have nice green stuff to eat through the winter. Wonderful. Right. For guys that don't have cattle or sheep and they don't want to get into cattle or sheep, then the question is, do you want incremental revenue through the winter on your soil? Right. Do you want an asset that's producing more revenue for you, or do you want to just sit around? So that's up to you. But me as a farmer, I'll take that revenue. You know, it comes back to what Gabe says about signing the back of the checks versus the front. And I always think that's like the greatest saying ever, right? That he came up
Gabe
with,
Brown,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And if I say Gabe, I don't know Gabe at all. So it's not like we're buddies. So
but you,
I want to make
had
that
Ray
clear.
Archuleta on your phone. You had Ray Archuleta on your phone.
Yeah.
So that's as close as you got.
In the last week. So, yeah, so I think that that's the way I look at it is regenerative ag. I think your arguments, as much as I'd like to see it, I think we, you know, as well as I do, people don't do things that lose money, one, and two, that are difficult with no immediate payoff. And so these are, you know, that second scenario is one that someone has to think through. Do I want to put fence around it? And how do I handle it? And how do I deal with that? And
yeah,
is
that's
it
a significant
the
shift from my normal winter, like say, yeah.
That's right. And water. And in the U.S., there is a program, and I'll be honest, I haven't had time to sign up for it on my land yet, but you could put solar pumps in, and the government helps defray some of those costs. Because you got to have water, right? That's the other challenge. If you can't just put them out in the field and, you know, they're not camels. And so there are some water needs, even through the winter months and certainly in the summer months.
Yeah. And then having living creatures that need daily moving in many cases or need care and checking in and all of that. Of course, they could run through fences every now and then and things like that. Yeah, it's very, very different. I can imagine that's a massive, quite a big jump to go from that to integrating animals, even though it probably is the biggest thing you can do, plus the cover crops and feeding them and et cetera, et cetera. But probably the biggest lever you have to kickstart soil biology and all of those nice things, it's not to be taken lightly in terms of what it means for your daily life, basically.
I agree. And it's an idea that's time, I think, is coming right now with commodity prices, falling again. And, more and more proof starting to show that, look, if you get the soil biology correct, and even on during the process, your need for synthetic, fertilizer is reduced. And so I think as commodity prices go down, you'll hear more and more reception around this, right? And that's just kind of how it works. So our timing's pretty good.
But maybe not with a machine yet or with a robot yet from your garage or your hangar or your storage. So what are other things you have changed your mind about in the last three and a half years? I mean, not that grazing is going to happen everywhere, but maybe not with the next iteration of the robot. What are other things you've significantly changed your mind about?
I think that's about it. That's one of the things we talk about at Greenfields. We really haven't made any substantial pivots. And by the way, the failed system we were working on, someone that's going to happen. You know, I just don't know exactly what the form factor will be and how it's going to work yet. But no, nothing has changed because I think their regenerative processes are still true. And it'll end up looking different than we all see it today, 20 years from now. But I still think the idea of the concept of, and it's beyond concept for a lot of farms now, but cover crops and cash crops and how those interplay and animals being involved on it, I think on broadacre ag is absolutely true. And we're seeing it more and more. And I certainly see it on my farm. And so nothing really has changed. There hasn't been a pivot from our perspective at all, really.
And so does it seem to you, I mean, is there a momentum building around regenerative ag? I mean, apart from the farmer side, but let's say beyond, I mean, the fact that a Chipotle comes out and visit, the fact that other companies start to at least procure part of their things. Like, does it feel like a momentum shift compared to 3, 4, or even 10 years ago, or is it still very, very early in your opinion?
No, I don't think it's very, very early anymore. I think you're on LinkedIn and you see it. I mean, you have guys running tractors between orchard rows and putting cover crops in, right? And so you're seeing that in all types of farming and people thinking through it. So we're certainly, you know, in the learning phase of the adoption curve, you know, before it's just sort of, you know, universities adopt and there's a stamped out way sort of people do this as a base system. But I think that's, by the way, one of the ways we'll know is when universities start teaching this, and this is sort of the base system, right? Right now that it is not what's happening, to my knowledge. So, but no, we're beyond these early phases, I think, at this point. We talk about this sometime at Greenfield, Stephen and I, you know, how do we compare this to the internet, right? Which we were, Stephen started in, I believe, in 1992 or 1994, somewhere in there. And so I talked, we talk about that and we compare this to the internet, right, in terms of robotics adoption, but also regenerative ag. And so we don't have a clear consensus. It's a little bit different when you're talking about physical stuff versus mostly digital. But we certainly are beyond the, you know, the very early days, in my opinion.
And how, I mean, talking about the technology piece, how has the technology piece developed, especially the software, especially AI, which got a lot of attention last year and the years before as well. But I don't think 3, 4 years ago, it wasn't a hype yet. I think it was a different hype. And like, has that significantly, has that made your life easier or not really yet? Or like, what have you seen on the picture recognition, the software piece, etc.?
Yeah, it's so early stage still. I mean, we're pretty basic stuff that we're doing that I guess you could call AI, and we do, but it's pretty basic. What will change, I believe, over time is, you know, this year we're looking at running upwards of in the, you know, you asked thousands versus tens of thousands of acres. Well, we're going for tens of thousands this year, and that'll start capturing some data over time. And I think we'll learn a bit over what's going on. And again, we're down low, so we can start capturing a lot more detailed data as to what's happening. So it's not high on our priority list for this season, but it won't be very hard to start adding some, you know, capabilities and cameras and start recording, you know, on tens of thousands and then the hundreds of thousands. And that's when I think AI really takes off. We've seen that with the LLMs and stuff, what they're doing. The more data, the more they learn, and the way you can go. So, although we're not working with language, but so we'll see how it all plays out over time. But I'm very practical about it. Is let's make sure we create the conditions and we solve a fundamental problem for the farmer first. The more of a footprint you have, the more you can learn, and the more we will learn, and the farmers will learn with us. And then the AI and such can learn alongside all of us as to what we're doing at that point. So the one notion I will reject today is the idea that we know exactly where a seed was planted. No, we don't. We have seen that over and over in fields. It is not as precise as everyone wants to act. There is no RTK perfect position for every single seed that is planted. But it is pretty good, you know, where things are in the rows and the variances are much less than they were 30 years ago. And the second notion is that we're going to take care of plants on a plant-by-plant basis. I'm not saying that won't happen in broadacre ag at some point, but I've been through this before in the internet where we were going to take care of customers on a customer-by-customer profile basis. And it took quite some time before that was reality. And that was in the digital world where it's much easier to do. And I was a data science guy before I moved back to Kansas. And now you can, right? You've got all the profiles, Facebook and Google and all that compiles data. But it took a long time in the digital world. Doing it on a plant by plant, 100,000 plants an acre soybean basis is not going to happen tomorrow. So.
And then as a sort of final one, you mentioned the soil measurement piece. Is that because farmers are asking for it? Is it because you find it interesting? Like who's the customer or the client there that wants that or is interested and also ultimately is going to pay for that?
Yeah, we have a soil testing partner. MKC is obviously working with us and another partner where we're trying to, you know, kind of finalize a deal with. And the idea is this. I start very simple, again, grid sampling, right? A lot of farmers do this, whether you agree with it or don't agree with it. And the idea is to drive down those costs so they can do it more often, right? And maybe tune their prescriptions a little bit better. And so that's where we're coming from, is to look at it from a pure cost savings perspective, not just on the testing itself, but also on your prescriptions being more accurate for what you're doing. So that's the goal there.
And how, because we've seen many startups, I think, as well in the soil measurement space, and how has that space evolved like over the last years? Or what do you see as the biggest potential breakthroughs or potential bottlenecks? And because you've been in this for a while, doing stuff in field, which most people haven't, like what's your view there on the carbon piece? Of course, we get a lot of hype still around that, but also on soil biology in general, or really understanding what's happening in it. What do you see there as a veteran in the field stuff?
I wouldn't call myself a veteran yet, that's for sure. ask me in 20,000 acres what I think of soil testing with the bots, but we are not there. Listen, I think there's a lot of companies working on these sort of digital probes, and we've got one partner and another one we're working on finalizing a deal with. And I don't think anyone's saying they're perfect or they're the end state, but it's a massive improvement over pulling a massive amount of samples and mailing them off somewhere. And so, you know, you're just trying to get close to an answer, right? And that, I think, is a big shift here, right? As we get more and more to where we can digitalize on-site results, you know, versus pulling something, the soil containing the data and shipping it off, and instead recognizing the soil data in its native format right there in the field, you know, that drives us down and allows things to become a little bit actionable at a much faster pace and much lower cost. Right now, when a farmer's doing grid sampling, they're doing it about every 3 or 4 years. And so this could get it down to where it'll be up to the farmer, but every 1 to 2 years, right? Really, it could get to the point they're doing it every year. So, and they should be.
Yeah, fascinating how that, because we really have very little clue of what's happening in field by field basis or in general, because it's just not being sampled and not regularly.
Yeah.
You're nodding no, but nobody sees that. Like, what's the
no, reaction? No, listen, no, I think that, I think there is, listen, you know, what have we been trying to, you and I know this, and I think a lot of people are coming to recognize this, both in human health and in soil health, we've been playing God for a long time. And we thought we could control the variables that we didn't even understand all the variables. We don't know what's in our gut, right? We know very little, right? And this started when I was 25 years old and I'm 50 now, right? And so I recognized this 25 years ago healing myself, right? And in my soil gut, right? Or not my soil gut, my gut, right?
That
and
I started figuring out. That was a good mistake.
You know, and I recognized, boy, there's just a lot. These guys want me to take these pills and there's a lot going on here that they don't understand. They don't know anything about. It hasn't been synthesized. We don't even, and not just synthesize what's in our gut, but also the interaction between them. The numbers are so massive that we still don't have a computer that's able to figure out those interactions. It's the same thing on the soil. I think we're all starting to figure that out. I think most farmers are starting to figure that out. There's complexity there. And so, you know, the things we're measuring today, we're going to be laughing just how stupid we were, 20 years from now, right? And how little we knew. But you got to hang your hat on something, right? You got to raise a crop. You have to, you know, even if you're at the meta level instead of the actual detail level, you have to be taking action as a farmer and making some sort of supposition about what you're doing. And so we're only touching the surface of what's capable or possible at this point. But we'll get better and better at this. I think my biggest fear is that we become arrogant and we make decisions and we do things that we don't understand the implications down the road with what we're doing. And so, again, that takes me back to the cover cropping, the grazing of animals, and all these things that get you to a point where you need fewer and fewer things to add to your crop as you're going, right? Either during season or between season. So I'm rambling a little bit here, but I think that it's, you know, right now we're going to do the things that farmers are used to doing. They'll just have more frequent adjustments, right, to what they've been doing. But hopefully we'll get beyond that. And it's not hopefully, we will. And we'll get better and better data, and we'll make more frequent adjustments as a result of that, and we'll go from there. But by the way, it's going to be very hard to make those more frequent adjustments with an absolute monster piece of equipment, you know?
And okay, so, yeah, a tractor that weighs, God knows how much, and compact soil
sprayer.
In a way. Yeah, and your sprayer.
Yeah. Right.
And, yeah,
and so I think drones and small rovers will be where we go, you know?
What would be the role of drones?
If you think about land-based, we're not going to win land speed records with our robots anytime soon. A drone
probably
can.
Better.
And so a drone can move faster. So drones can do some things, and they can also certainly collect data much, much faster. And so to enable the rover to know where it's going. So just think about our weeding scenario right now. Right now, we run a field. We pretty much run the whole field. That won't be the case in 2 years. So, we'll have better data on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so then you get to a point where. Yep. And the energy savings from that alone are massive, right? And when we talk about energy savings, it's not just energy savings of batteries in our case. It's the energy savings of the humans that maintain the equipment and all the wasted time you ran with those and all the wasted time someone's maintaining them. And so that, you know, the payoff will be massive. And I think drones will have something to do with that. They already do for us. So.
Yeah, no, the development went really fast as well. Like that's the higher end commercial normal drones, almost consumer drones you can buy now compared to 5-10 years ago, it's just another world. And the costs compared to that completely. And so as a final question, are you optimistic, like from what you've seen over the last years? I mean, let's say the use of chemicals hasn't really dropped yet. The effects are starting to become much more visible and have become more visible over the last years. And so what gives you optimism if you're optimistic and what drives you? I mean, what drives you is clear, but what keeps you getting out of bed in the morning to see, I mean, going to 10,000 acres and more, but compared to where it's sprayed, that's still tiny, unfortunately. What keeps you going?
Yeah. I actually think we've already won. And I tell the team that. I said, it's just execution now. The tide has already turned. And I think even the guys that have been traditionally doing a lot of agrochemicals and seed attached that actually already know that too. And you can look at their M&A.
What moment was the moment that the tide turned?
Just go look at their mergers and, you know, what companies they're buying and that they're looking at biologicals more now and stuff like that, which I think has its own risk.
Buying a few biological companies, yeah. Syngenta the same.
Yeah. And I think there's a recognition there that chemicals are being reduced. Or you look at MKC, our partner, right? Are they still spraying chemicals? You bet. Vast majority. And so when we did the deal, the announcement was, look, we're looking at all paths, right? And so that's a nod to something new is coming along now, and it's early in it. It won't be overnight, but the change is happening, and I think the change is absolute. Listen, if I show up with an argument tomorrow that our robots could take over your fields with no chemicals involved whatsoever and create X new revenue opportunities tomorrow, and I had all the machines to do it, and it was absolutely proven. There is zero farmers who tell me no, not one, not one. No one's attached to what we've been doing the last 40 years anymore, right? So remember, a lot of guys were tilling that moved to no-till, right? And so, but it took time. And so that's where we're at. And so no, I tell the team, like, we're not the one on the precipice, you know, that if the wind blows sharply, we're going to fly off it. It's chemicals that are on the precipice that are about to be blown right off over the cliff, right? And so it just doesn't look like it right now, right? And it's similar to the internet in 1997 when people were like, oh, we'll never, you know, everyone likes to go physically shop and e-commerce won't be a big deal. Or a record company that told us, well, we control all of our music, so we'll decide when it gets distributed online, and the Napster appeared 2 years later, right? So it these things move fast, but they'll move slower in ag because it's actual physical stuff, right?
I think it's a perfect end to this conversation. I want to thank you so much, Clint, for the work you do and for coming on here in what must be a very busy winter, getting a lot more machines ready and getting a lot more suppliers to, or buyers, and they are suppliers to buy stuff from the farmers you work with. So thank you so much for coming on here and share about the progress in the last 3.5 and of course also before years.
Well, we're both still here, which is exciting. So congrats
still
on
going
your,
strong.
What did you say, 300 plus now or about 300?
Almost, no, yeah, we're, I think this would be, depending a bit on when it gets out, I think around 278 or 9. And then we have one series actually with Benedict Bozo we didn't count, which was 9 episodes. So yeah, 290, something like that.
That's a lot. That's a lot. That's amazing. Congrats. So, keeping going.
And some people have listened to almost all of them, which I applaud them for. But it's, yeah, it's that's over 300 hours of stuff. Yeah.
Well, hopefully we have a third one in the future.
We will. We will. I mean, if you make it for through the first few years, the chances are just that you keep going are pretty high.
Hopefully.
Thank you so much.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Cohn.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again and see you next time.